Good morning. I now call this remote meeting of the House Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order, and we will begin by taking the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Swazinski. Minority Lead Swazinski. Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman. Representative Bowe.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present. Present.
Mr. Hermanson, are you with us?
Swazinski present.
Testing, can you guys hear me?
Now we can hear you.
I can't hear anyone else.
Can you hear us now?
Bueller.
Looks like it has been fixed. Representative Christensen.
Present.
All right, thank you. Apologies for that. Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
I believe Minority Lead Swazinski has joined us.
Yes, sir. Present.
All right. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lippertz.
Lippert, present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, present.
Representative Mecklens.
Mecklen, present.
Representative Munson.
Munson, present.
Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson.
A quorum is present. And so we don't have minutes for this meeting. We'll be hearing from the budget presentations in a second, but looks like Representative Swazinski, you have a question to start us off.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Was just kind of, obviously we're kind of in the timeline of budget deadlines and the rest. And House File 1031 is a Stevenson bill that I believe is this committee's budget. Kind of wanted to see what the plan was as far as will we be actually hearing that budget bill in your committee? I know we're not a budget committee. We're purely policy. Wanted to see kind of what the plan was with that, and then how it will travel through to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the question, Representative Swazinski. I don't know House File 1031 by number, but I'm happy to look into it, and I can get back to you later today. Any further questions, Representative Swazinski?
Mr. Chair, do we plan on hearing any budget-related bills to this committee, or do we just be talking about the policy?
We're having the budget presentations this morning from the commission, and then we will be putting together our omnibus budget bill. So with that, we will go ahead, and our first presentation is from the Public Utilities Commission, and I believe we have Mr. Seifert with us to present. I don't know if you have others joining us, but Mr. Seifert, take it away.
I'm here.
Oh, Commissioner Sullivan as well. Commissioner Sullivan, welcome to the committee.
Hi, Chair Long. It's nice to be here. It's nice to see all the members of the commission it's nice to see all the members of the committee. And thank you for the opportunity to present here. So the Executive Secretary Seifert and I are going to split up our duties here on the presentation. And first, I'm going to speak to just the general structure of the commission and who we regulate and kind of how we operate. I will take about 5 minutes and then I'll hand it over to Mr. Seifert. So first, the PUC's mission is to create and maintain a regulatory environment that ensures safe, reliable, and efficient utility services at fair and reasonable rates. The Public Utilities Commission is Minnesota's oldest regulatory body. It's changed a lot since it was formed more than 100 100 years ago. It was originally the Railroad and Warehouse Commission, which was formed in 1871. So actually 150 years ago, we can update our talking points. Today, the commission no longer regulates railroad and warehouses. Today, we regulate electric, natural gas, and telephone service in Minnesota. And our primary responsibilities are to make sure that Minnesotans can get safe, reliable, and affordable utility service. I think it's really critical that folks understand that we're an independent agency. We're not members of the governor's cabinet. We recognize the decisions of the agency impact the lives of Minnesotans in a variety of ways. Whether that's through the rates that are charged to state-sanctioned monopolies, the quality of electric, natural gas, or landline telephone service, or the quality of nearby energy generation and transmission systems. So if we some of the examples in state statute that we specifically regulate under the rate case is in 216B.16, renewable energy objectives, electric vehicle charging rates, and community solar gardens. So a little bit more about the agency. We're a 5-member quasi-judicial decision-making board. The governor selects the commission's chair, whose term is concurrent with that of the governor. And the chair functions like a principal executive officer of the agency and has statutory authority to preside over the commission meetings and upon commission approval, give direction to the staff through the executive secretary. Our current membership of the commission, we have, as I said, we have 5 commissioners, but they live in the congressional districts, CD1. I live in Mankato, so I live in CD1, CD2, CD4, and CD8. So we have a pretty wide representation throughout the state. Some of the other qualifications I think it's important for, we have staggered 6-year terms, full-time positions. We can't have more than 3 from one political party. The state statute requires that the commissioners are learned in law, engineering, finance, utility, property valuation, and generally representative of the public. And as I said before, it's not a cabinet level agency. It's independent from the commission. A little bit more about our decision-making process and the code of conduct, which are really important and also very misunderstood. But the agency is a quasi-judicial agency. So that means that every decision we look at is case by case, and it's based on the record before us, the record that's developed in the case. There is no ex parte communication. So much like a judge, commissioners, we cannot have off the record conversations or discussions with parties about material issues in any pending or disputed case. The role in these procedures, like the Department of Commerce, is a participant in agency decisions they present before the commission. Also, the Office of the Attorney General does as well. And then there are many parties that are involved in our decisions. We're also subject to the state's open meeting law. So all of our meetings and decisions are publicly noticed and they're open meetings. And lastly, our decisions are that this commission, you often hear the commissioners say the commission speaks through its orders. That's how the commission speaks. I always will say this commissioner thinks, and that's the reason is the commission itself speaks through its orders. We regulate, as I said before, electricity. We regulate investor-owned utilities, Xcel, Minnesota Power, Ottertail. We also regulate Dakota Electric, which is a consumer-owned utility, a co-op, but they've regulated by the commission. So they've petitioned us to be regulated, even though They're not an investor-owned utility. They've asked that we regulate. So we do regulate Dakota Electric, but they could choose not to be regulated by us. On the gas side, we regulate the investor-owned gas utilities, CenterPoint, Minnesota Energy Resources, Xcel, Greater Minnesota Gas, and Great Plains. And then on telecom, our regulation is a little bit different, but it's through alternative forms approved by the legislature. Some of the key things that we do regulate are service quality for electric and natural gas service, rates for investor-owned utilities, and the member utilities, customer-owned utilities who Dakota Electric, who've chosen to have their rates regulated. Resource selection, so what types of resources that are used in generating power, large energy facilities, the certificate of need, the need analysis and siting and routing, local telephone service, and then regional, the planning that goes into regional wholesale energy markets. And now I will turn it over to our executive secretary, Mr. Seifert. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Seifert, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chair, committee members, Will Seifert, Executive Secretary, Public Utilities Commission. Just in the interest of time, I'll try to go through these next couple slides fairly quickly, but to give you a little bit of a picture of the staff that and the structure that supports commission decision-making. Generally, more than half of the commission staff work in the Regulatory Analysis Division. Regulatory analysts from that division are responsible for analyzing and interpreting the issues that go before the commission to help the commissioners make decisions. This division is made up of three subunits: the financial analysis unit, which handles utility rate cases, riders, and other things; the economic analysis unit, which handles telecommunications, utility long-term planning and service quality and other emerging issues; and the energy facilities permitting unit, which handles energy facility applications. The firm facilities permitting unit also contains a public advisor whose role is to assist members of the public in participating in energy facility proceedings. Agency also has three other units. The legal unit drafts the commission's orders. The consumer affairs office mediates complaints about utilities from utility customers, provides outreach and assistance with cold weather rule implementation, TAP enrollment, which is the telephone assistance program, federal lifeline program, and other related programs. I also just want to make a note here, if your constituents experience issues with their utilities, you're welcome to refer them to our CAO team, either through us as staff or the contact is on the website. And then finally, the business services unit manages the agency's operations and finances and provides general administrative support. Our office is located in downtown St. Paul at the Metro Square building. So in 2021, the agency operated with an appropriation of $7.772 million per year. 100% of the agency's expenditures are recovered through special assessment authority, and that's defined in statutes 216B.62, and it's returned to the general fund. About 97% of the agency's budget goes to staff compensation, office space, and IT support. Other operating expenses, including office supplies, professional development, professional technical contracts, et cetera, make up about 3% of the agency's budget. The agency also administers the telephone assistance program from a special revenue fund. Here, reimbursement grants are provided to telephone companies who assist their eligible low-income customers with reduced rates. This fund continues to decrease as people move away from landline service. For the upcoming biennium, the commission is seeking an operating adjustment of 2 and 3%, roughly consistent with the level requested by our sister agencies across the enterprise. As I noted in the previous slide, 97% of the agency's budget goes to staff compensation, office space, and IT support. As operating costs steadily increase, we face tough staffing decisions in managing vacancies. How long can we hold positions open? Do they need to be filled, et cetera? With roughly 900 utility filings made annually, these staffing decisions have an impact on the speed that we can resolve disputes and manage the regulatory work of the agency. Moreover, the complexity of dockets before the commission is also increasing. As I previously noted, the appropriation would be assessed and returned to the general fund. We appreciate the committee's consideration of this request. Before concluding our presentation, I want to highlight how the agency has managed through the COVID-19 pandemic. While the staff almost entirely moved to remote work in March of 2020, the agency has maintained its productivity, generating roughly 300 orders last year, consistent with average output over the past 3 years. Since April of 2020, all PUC meetings have been held virtually with options for video and phone participation, providing the public with expanded opportunities to participate in commission proceedings. We plan to continue this access once we are meeting in person again. In addition to operational changes, the commission has opened up a series of investigations to ensure consumers are protected during these tough times, to track utility costs and savings, and to understand the economic impacts of accelerating certain types of utility investments, as well as considering and approving several modifications to existing tariffs and new tariffs to provide specific relief due to COVID, such as modifications to business development rates. If you'd like more information about any of the COVID dockets, it's available on our homepage. And with that, that concludes our presentation, and Commissioner Sullivan and I are happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you so much, Mr. Seifert. Looks like we do have a question, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for the presentation. So where are we at on the natural gas? We hear there's going to be such a spike on prices, you know, with the Texas debacle down there. And any input on that as you how it'll affect consumers or what the current status is?
So Representative Grunhagen, we're going to be having a hearing tomorrow on that issue and on a bill that I'm bringing forward. So we'll have a lot of discussion on that issue tomorrow. And I know that Commissioner Sullivan is planning to testify then as well.
Okay.
Any further questions? Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Seifert, so I'm just kind of curious, is there a code of conduct for the commissioners?
Mr. Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, there is a code of conduct.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you. Does the code of conduct, Mr. Seifert, allow commissioners to engage in political activity?
It's Seifert.
Seifert, sorry.
No problem. Mr. Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm going to pull that rule together and I'll send it to you and the committee for your reference. I don't have a clear answer for you, so I don't want to speculate.
Okay. One final question.
Representative Franzen.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Seifert, sorry, I'm terrible at pronouncing names. Can commissioners make donations to political parties or partisan PACs?
Mr. Seifert. Sounds like you'll look into that as well.
I'll look into that, and I'll answer both of those questions for you, and I'll send the response to the staff so it can get to all committee members too.
Great. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Seifert. I don't see further questions, so we'll move on to Temporary Commissioner Arnold for the Department of Commerce's budget presentation. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Long and members. I'm joined by a couple of my colleagues today. Tim Jenke is our CFO. Jessica Burdett is a frequent flyer in this committee, as you know, and is in our Division of Energy Resources. And Sergio, who is hopefully going to put the slides up, is on our Government Affairs team. All right. Thank you, Sergio. So members, I'm pleased to be here today. For the record, I'm Grace Arnold. I'm the temporary commissioner for the Department of Commerce. So I'll give a brief orientation to the department and then we'll talk through the pieces of the department that are under this committee's purview. The mission of the department is focused around the people of Minnesota and their everyday financial transactions. Commerce's work on behalf of Minnesotans is to investigate and evaluate those financial transactions and to advocate for those services to be fair, accessible, and affordable. Next slide, please, Sergio. This is our leadership team. You'll note here that I'm listed twice as I'm in this role on a temporary basis, and the governor is in the process of nominating or appointing the next commissioner. We have a wonderful team that delivers you all the services you see here. You can go on, Sergio. Great. So our department is fairly small in terms of employees in relation to other state agencies, but we cover a wide range of industries and services, again, all focused on the financial transactions of Minnesotans in their everyday lives. I'll focus today on the portions of the department that are in green, which is the Division of Energy Resources and the Petrofund Program. Next slide, please. Thank you. I'll refer back to the Commission's mission, or to Commerce's mission, sorry, to evaluate, investigate, and advocate for consumer services, which guides how we promote clean, reliable, and affordable energy for Minnesota businesses and homes, how we advocate on behalf of consumers and ratepayers at proceedings at the Public Utilities Commission involving the regulated utilities. And we provide additional programs and services that are shown on this slide and that you've heard about in various forms in this committee. Next slide, please, Sergio. Thank you. So I'll turn now to talk about the Petrofund program. This is another important service that we deliver, which manages our petroleum energy resources when they create problems for users and communities. Leaks from petroleum storage tanks are one of the nation's leading causes of groundwater pollution. And as you can see from the stats on this slide, the Petrofund plays an essential role in helping tank owners fix problems that would otherwise be cost prohibitive. Without this program, tank owners would have been fully on the hook for these costs, and likely the storage tanks wouldn't have been remediated and would have risked polluting the polluting groundwater. Next slide, please, Sergio. So before I get into our budget requests, I'd like to give you a bit of an overview of Commerce's overall budget. This is Commerce's revenue by program. As you can see, Commerce brings in about $700 million per year. The Division of Energy Resources brings in the most funds, primarily through our energy assistance and weatherization programs. Both of those are federal grants. Revenue in the Enforcement Division is primarily related to securities, insurance fraud prevention, and auto theft prevention. And then revenue in Admin Services primarily comes from the unclaimed property and licensing functions. Next slide, please. So expenditures have a similar pattern. The vast majority of our expenditures come from federal funding. The purple wedge you see is energy assistance and weatherization. And then the premium security account, which doesn't fall under this committee's jurisdiction, but is also a federal program that funds a program on the individual health insurance market. So as you'll see, those are our two largest expenditures, and again, they're federal funds. So I'll now transition to the Department of Commerce's budget recommendations. So as I mentioned earlier, this is specific to the Division of Energy Resources and the Petrofund program. So the first recommendation is repealing the sunset of the energy planning and systems assessment. It's currently set to it's currently going to sunset on June 30th of this year. This assessment is an amount up to $500,000 per year and is split between the electric utilities for the actual costs of providing regional and national grid reliability. The work is ongoing in order to maintain reliable energy services for Minnesotans. This assessment provides annual funding for participating in regional and federal electric and natural gas reliability oversight, ensuring adequate and secure generation and transmission resources to serve Minnesota homes and businesses. This work also includes advocating on behalf of Minnesota interests, such as reliability, cost, and use of various energy resources, in MISO's stakeholder meetings, ensuring adequate generation and other resources to serve Minnesota customers in integrated resource plans, and using computer modeling for needed analyses in integrated resource plans. We're also joining with FERC on MISO petitions and representing Minnesota in ongoing consumer complaints about high rates of return on equity on transmission resources. Maintaining these existing positions through this funding is critical to maintaining an affordable and, in particular, a reliable energy system. Members know that we have spent some time together recently talking about the importance of reliable and integrated energy systems. This funding is essential to that work. Without this assessment, the department would not have the resources to complete the technical analyses needed to ensure the reliability of the state's electric system. Next slide, please. Thank you. Our next proposal is another repealing of a sunset date, and that's for the Petro Fund program. Petro Fund program is currently set to sunset on June 30th of 2022. The Petro Fund program is a necessary service that's utilized by Minnesotans across the state. As I mentioned earlier, the Petro Fund provides vital financing to tank owners who need that assistance. And through that assistance, we help protect Minnesota's environment and groundwater. Due to bipartisan and industry support of the Petro Fund program, the sunset date, and I'll put that in quotes, has been extended on 5 previous occasions, most recently in 2016. Owners of petroleum storage tanks and petroleum contaminated property will see a direct financial benefit from the continued existence of the Petro Fund program, which provides reimbursement of up to 90% of costs to investigate and clean up contamination from leaking tanks. This proposal does not increase the department's employee count, and it just continues the program at existing staffing and funding levels. The program is funded through the petroleum tank release cleanup fee. In addition, this proposal expands the eligibility criteria for the Petro Fund abandoned underground storage tank removal program to include abandoned tanks located on properties that have been taken over by the state due to tax forfeiture. So this is something that's been brought to our attention as a need, and inclusion of tax forfeited properties into this program will allow for expedient removal of the tanks and their contents, identification, and cleanup activities. Once the tanks are removed, these properties are much more likely to be purchased and developed by private parties. And redeveloping these properties currently is more difficult, particularly in greater Minnesota when there is this kind of pollution on the property. Next slide, please, Sergio. So the next proposal that we have is canceling the general fund appropriation of the Healthy Air Program and appropriating the current funding out of the renewable development account. Minnesota's weatherization assistance program is unable to assist these households that are eligible for healthy air because vermiculite insulation is present and often contains asbestos, which is known to cause cancer. Federal funds can be used to test for vermiculite and to provide weatherization services once it's safely removed, but these funds are not allowed to be used to remove this hazardous material. Vermiculite insulation is a major reason why an increasing number of otherwise eligible Minnesota homes are denied weatherization services. In some parts of Minnesota, deferral rates are well over 54% of the eligible dwellings, with vermiculite being the number one reason for deferral. To address this issue in 2017, the legislature appropriated $150,000 annually from the general fund for a new grant program called Healthy Air. AIR, of course, is an acronym, which stands for Asbestos Insulation Remediation Program. This program provides 2 benefits in one proposal. Healthy Air removes the hazardous cancer-causing material from homes of low-income Minnesotans, especially those more vulnerable due to age, illness, or disability. And then these homes are able to receive federally funded weatherization services, which are otherwise denied to them, which saves residents money. With the funding in the RDA proposal, the program will go unchanged. It's just moving the money. The Healthy Air Program naturally fits within the RDA, which has 3 main goals, including to stimulate innovative energy projects, which reduce demand and increase system efficiency and flexibility. Next slide, please. All right. I would be remiss if I didn't direct you to our government affairs team with any additional questions. So thank you again, Chair Long and members, for giving us time to present. And I'm happy to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you so much. Members, are there any questions? I do not see any. It seems like you were thorough. Well, thank you very much for the budget presentations today from the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce. And we will move on to our bills. So members, we have 3 bills in front of us today. And the first is House File 1879 from Representative Lippert. Representative Lippert, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1879 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Lippert moves that House File 1879 be laid over, and I understand that you have an author's amendment.
I do. I move the A1 amendment. And this amendment deletes section 2 of the bill. MPCA didn't feel this section was necessary and others agreed to remove it as well.
Representative Lippert moves the A1. Any discussion to the A1? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A1 is adopted. Representative Lippert, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill seeks to take advantage of the opportunity for solar on closed landfills in Minnesota. According to a feasibility study by the Environmental Quality Board, there are currently 110 landfills in the closed landfill program in the state. There's the potential to install 950 megawatts of solar on 4,500 acres, enough solar energy to power 100,000 homes. The challenge is that unretired general obligation bonds are connected to half of the closed landfill sites. Federal and state law prohibit the use of sites with unpaid bonds for private purposes. This bill then sets up a pilot project to use $3 million in RDA funds to pay off general obligation bonds connected to the Ramsey and Anoka closed landfill. The bill also calls for a report to be completed that would include challenges or barriers faced during development and after the completion of the project and replicability of the project to other closed landfill sites. My first testifier today is David Schaefer.
Mr. Schaefer, welcome to the committee.
Hi. Chair Long and members of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee, I am David Schaefer, Executive Director of MNCEA. I want to thank you all for hearing House File 1879 and specifically thank Representative Lippert for bringing this bipartisan bill forward. Brightfields, or the concept of putting solar on closed landfills, really started to generate some momentum 2 years ago with the first Brightfields bill that resulted in a study published in 2020. House File 1879 was put together collaboratively with several cities, nonprofits, state agencies, and other organizations that care passionately about Brightfields deployment. It largely adopts the findings of the study. The bill generally does two things to move Brightfields forward in Minnesota. First, it enables the Pollution Control Agency to regulate the reuse and redevelopment of these sites to make sure that the potential environmental challenges of building on or near a landfill cap are sufficiently monitored by the state. This expands our state's available space for economic development while keeping our citizens safe. This bill also addresses a regulatory hurdle that has precluded Brightfields development. The study determined that about half of the closed landfills in Minnesota have general obligation bonds on them. The rules around those bonds preclude economic activity on these sites for the duration of the bond, which can be as long as 37 and a half years. It's unclear as to how the bonds can be paid down or removed, but it does seem likely that the state can pay off the bond using renewable development account dollars or other state appropriated funds. Conexus Energy, who is here today, the largest electric cooperative in the state, wants to do a solar project on a closed landfill. This project is really a pilot, hopefully the first of many Brightfields here in Minnesota. This pilot would give us an opportunity to see if MNB is able to release the funds to allow for the development of a Brightfields project. And then if for some reason MNB is unable to waive the bond obligation, they will need to report back on what the obstacles are so you all can make legislative changes accordingly. If the funding can go forward, then Conexus will get to build its project and they will report back to the legislature with MNB and PCA on how the project went and if using state or RDA dollars to pay off bonds when projects like this one emerge is a viable pathway forward for getting more solar on closed landfills. One of the benefits of using RDA dollars for a project like this is that it is an account designed exactly for this type of project. It's money set aside for renewable energy projects. Additionally, this RDA payment would pay down a bond and would not go to Conexus directly, thus saving taxpayers money. I do acknowledge that this is an expenditure on a project that's outside of Xcel service territory, but this project not only will help taxpayers, who are often Xcel ratepayers, will also make a template that many closed landfill projects can use that are within Xcel service territory. I think they have about 17 of them in total. The knowledge of how to replicate these projects is something that will eventually benefit all ratepayers in Minnesota. And if Xcel wants to move forward with similar projects, we will be there to assist them with those efforts as well. In closing, House File 1879 makes too much sense for Minnesota not to do. It takes an emerging technology and puts it in spots that make the most sense. If we can figure out how to make Brightfields work by reducing regulatory barriers, then everybody wins. With that, I ask for this bill to be laid over and considered in this year's Energy Omnibus Bill. Thank you all for considering this bill. Thank you again to Representative Lippert for carrying it, and I'm happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Representative Lippert, I believe you have one more testifier.
I do, Mr. Chair. That's correct. Brian Brandt is here to testify from Conexus as well.
Mr. Brandt, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Brian Brandt, Vice President of Power Supply and Business Development at Conexus Energy. We are a member-owned distribution cooperative serving 138,000 members in 1,000 square miles of the North Metro. Our service area includes portions of 7 counties, which includes the state districts of 12 senators and 20 representatives. 2 of the esteemed members of this committee have districts that overlap with the Conexus service area. These are districts 15B and 36A. Our residential and commercial business members seek reliable, safe, and affordable electricity. Our democratically elected business board of directors and progressive management have endeavored and kept our rates flat for 4 consecutive years. In 2021, we reduced our rates for business accounts by 2%. Many efforts contribute to our record, including Minnesota state leadership advancing environmental sustainability, new resources like wind, solar, and battery storage. Conexus has 20 megawatts of solar and 15 megawatts of battery storage. We are currently looking for sites to add more solar. That is why this bill is of interest to Conexus. This morning, I wholeheartedly speak in favor of House File 1879, Brightfields 2.0, solar at closed landfills. This act builds upon the 2019 appropriation of funds to the Environmental Quality Board to study the feasibility of solar development on state-managed closed landfills. We thank you for funding this study. It identified 110 closed state-permitted landfills spread throughout the state. Half these sites have restrictions, just like the closed Anoka Ramsey landfill, because of past general obligation financing. We identified the Anoka Ramsey landfill back in 2016 as a potential location for solar and began working with the MPCA. However, after a period of several months, we had to shelve this site after learning about the restrictions related to the general obligation funds. The closed Anoka Ramsey landfill could be the first Brightfields example where a utility partners with the state to develop solar, providing land lease revenue to the state and local renewable generation. If House File 1879 is approved, Conexus will commit to working with the state and developing an approximate 30-acre solar project on the skirt land surrounding the closed Anoka Ramsey landfill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This concludes my testimony.
Thank you so much. We have 2 individuals who've signed up for public testimony. First, we'll hear from Kirk Kadelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and work on land policy issues. First off, I want to thank the Chair and supporters of the bill for the amendment removing Section 2. It does address many of our concerns that we've outlined in previous testimony and some unintended consequences that were caused by it. So we do appreciate that. So what I'd like to do today just briefly is leave a couple questions for the committee and others to look at as we start having further conversations about the closed landfill sites in our closed landfill program and how they may be used for energy or other types of reuse projects. We're going to refrain and defer to the Department of Commerce and others on the questions of what is the appropriate funding source for it or sites. But there are some things as we look to use potentially other revenue sources for these types of projects where there are lease revenues. Questions about where those lease revenues should go to. Currently, they would go to the remediation fund, which would fund further cleanup of our 110 contaminated sites. However, since they are from energy projects, the question is this an opportunity to create a revolving program which would help pay off the next set of landfills and bond pieces? So that's one thing I think that we should have some more conversations on. And then two, just long-term, if this bill really is about a pilot project to start off one specific location, or if this is meant to be a build out a more robust program for the closed landfill program, we'd like to have continued conversations with the legislature and others about what that would look like and how to balance the needs of the primary mission of the program, which is protecting human health and the environment from these sites, but also advance reuse and brownfield development. Thank you, representatives.
Thank you. And next we will hear from Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Excuse me, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. The RDA and its predecessor, the RDF, were created out of legislation passed in 1994. At that time, renewable energy was a small industry struggling to compete. The fund, which is collected exclusively from Xcel Energy customers, was a modest effort to direct resources to help this industry get up and running and to promote innovation in the application of renewable energy. Now, almost 30 years later, renewable energy is a thriving industry and increasingly competitive in the marketplace. Yet Xcel Energy customers continue to pay tens of millions of dollars a year into the account through their energy bills. Over that period, the fund has been applied to many uses, including some only remotely connected to its original purpose. House File 1879 sets a new precedent for the RDA expenditures, using money collected exclusively from Xcel Energy customers to retire the debt incurred by a political subdivision. Essentially, Xcel Energy customers are being required to pay off someone else's mortgage. The connection to actual renewable energy is one step removed from this expenditure. By paying off the debts of others, Xcel Energy customers are asked to facilitate a solar development by another utility, not Xcel Energy, one whose customers make no contribution to the RDA and who, in fact, would actively resist any attempts to have them contribute to the RDA. As this discussion moves forward, we would ask the committee, particularly those who represent Xcel Energy customers, whether this proposed use of the RDA is the direction that we should go. We would suggest that it is not. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll turn to any member questions if there are any. I'm not seeing hands. Representative Lippert, would you care to make some closing comments to your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the committee's time and the time of testifiers today. I've certainly opened a conversation about other state finances for this project, but do think that the point Mr. Schaefer made was important too, that there are 17 closed landfill sites within Xcel territory, and if this could help find a pathway for that, that does seem to be a good argument for RDA usage, but open to more conversation about that going forward. So I thank everyone for their time.
Thank you so much, Representative Lippert. Representative Lippert renews his motion, and House File 1879 is laid over. Next, we will turn to House File 2054, which is Representative Christensen's bill. Representative Christensen, would you care to move your bill? Representative Christensen, you'll need to unmute.
I'd like to move, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the bill to be laid over.
Representative Christensen moves that House File 2054 be laid over, and I believe you have an author's amendment, Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A2 amendment is a technical amendment that'll clarify that this bill applies only to plants within Minnesota. So, it's really kind of a technical change here. It also clarifies the language on training and costs included in the rate base. The rest of the sort of minor fixes in here are really just language fixes. So I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Representative Christensen moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Christensen, please tell us about your bill.
Okay, thank you, Chair Long and members of the committee. House File 2045, the Power Plant Worker Transition Bill, is designed to provide a measure of certainty and accountability for workers at power plants that are slated to close. Over the next 15 years, we're scheduled to see the closure of the 6 remaining coal-fired power plants in the state. The approximately 600 workers at those plants face an increasingly uncertain future as jobs within the utilities shrink and opportunities outside for jobs at similar pay and benefits narrow. House File 2054 aims to help workers at the state's remaining power plants by minimizing the negative financial impacts from the closures, protecting pensions and other benefits, providing training for other jobs within the utility, and or for new careers for workers who choose to or are forced to leave, and providing workers with increased options and greater certainty. Under the bill, when utilities announce a plant closure, they'll be required to work with the unions at the plant to create plans that reflect the goals outlined above and allow for reasonable costs to be included in the rate base. Under the legislation, the plans would be submitted in the utility's integrated Resource Plan. The plans would be evaluated by the Public Utilities Commission, providing accountability to the utilities and protecting the interests of ratepayers. On hand today, I have Kurt Zimmerman of IBEW Local 160, which represents the workers at the Sherco facility, and Dwayne Peters of IBEW Local 23, which represents workers at the King Plant. I also have on hand Joel Johnson, a legislative liaison from the IBEW. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Mr. Zimmerman, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman Long and the committee members. I appreciate the time to talk to you today. I'm speaking to you today in support of House File 2054. As we all know, as Representative Christensen just stated, that Xcel Energy has announced the closure of these sites, and we'd like to have the ability to try to negotiate some things in this transition. Being a former employee of the Sherco plant myself for over 25 years, it's concerning that the questions that we need answered, we could get done with this bill, so to speak. Representative talked about the pensions. The unions have negotiated a pension benefit years ago for these employees that the pension is based on a rule of 90. So if your age and your years of service, you become pension eligible. If there's a transition in that to where somebody would leave before that, there's severe reductions in the benefit, the negotiated benefit that we have established. So we'd like to be able to work with the company in negotiating this, along with the change of potential jobs and retraining, whether it's different apprenticeships for employees that are going to be left after the closure, because right now with Sherco, at the end of the timeline, there's roughly about 82 people left that are going to be affected by the shutdown. So Xcel has a vast service territory, Dakotas, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Texas, and Colorado. We'd like to be able to place these people within their current location or within the current local's jurisdiction. We don't want to have to try to negotiate something to uproot somebody and send them to Lubbock, Texas, for example. So with that, we're in support of this bill. I'd like to thank Representative Christensen for bringing this forward. And Mr. Chairman, I thank you for your time for testifying, and committee members. And with that, I will close my testimony and stand for questions if there are any.
Thank you so much. And if you wouldn't mind just stating your name and organization for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Kurt Zimmerman. I'm a business representative for the IBEW Local 160. I represent the workers at the Sherco plant.
Thank you so much, Mr. Zimmerman. And next, we will be hearing from Mr. Dwayne Peters. Mr. Peters, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Long, committee members. My name is Dwayne Peters. I'm business manager for Local 23 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Local 23 represents approximately 65 members at the Xcel Energy L&S King plant located in Bayport. The ages of these members range from their early 20s to their mid-50s, with years of service from less than a year to their mid-30s. We are currently in talks with Xcel Energy concerning the future of active members at the time of the plant closure. We've agreed that the senior 11 operators from the operator section would stay on site at the plant till the closure and would finish their careers at the Highbridge combined cycle plant. With that said, pending the closure date and attrition, this could leave 25 to 40 members facing uncertain futures. As I've stated, we are in talks with Xcel Energy of verbal assurances that all will continue to have employment. We are working with the company on a job fair so that the members can research other areas to transition to, but the members are still concerned with training for these other areas and the uncertainty of the plant closure date of 2028 or sooner. We feel this legislation is needed to protect our members and preserve the good paying union jobs, which in turn is a win for the state of Minnesota as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Peters. Looks like we believe are ready for member questions. And so we will begin with Representative Swazinski. Representative Swazinski, did you have a question?
Sorry, can you hear me now? I think I thought I had you on
mute. Yep, we can hear you now.
Off mute. Just a quick question. So you know, obviously this bill potentially has bipartisan support. You know, we don't want to use leverage on a lot of these bills that pertain to people's lives. I forgot, what was the motion on this bill?
The motion was to lay it over Representative Swasinski.
You know, if you're looking for, you know, obviously we heard last night on the very few bills that have passed or been even brought to the floor. You know, I would encourage the chair to maybe redo the motion and just bring this particular bill right to the floor for consideration before the body, rather than encumber it with a lot of potential controversial pieces of legislation that might move forward. You know, I think you'll find that you have an opportunity to pass a bill with bipartisan support rather than look at very partisan policies that would be intermingled with it. And just in general, had a question, is Representative Stevenson still on the call?
Yes, looks like he is.
You heard where we stand potentially on House File 2054, but just was trying to double check. We had talked a little bit earlier about the budgetary bills, and we've kind of got two bills, House File 1031, which you were not super familiar with, but I believe it's a Rep. Stevenson bill. So this climate portion of that, would we be hearing that portion of the budget bill in energy, or will it move without moving through the regular process? What's your plan with that bill?
So Representative Swasinski, I think that's a question for me. And so as I mentioned when you asked the question earlier, we just heard the budget presentations earlier from the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce, and they spoke to the provisions that are related to the budget from their proposals. And so that was our informational hearing on the budget proposals from the commission.
So Mr. Chair, that is your budget hearing. So we will not actually be taking the bill up as the portions of those bills in this committee. It'll only pass through Commerce by itself as an actual bill.
Representative Swasinski, we can't move any bills out of this committee without taking them up, and we will certainly be taking under consideration the Public Utilities Commission and Department of Commerce recommendations for their budget. And if we include those in our finance bill, then all members of this committee will have an opportunity to offer amendments to those provisions before we vote them out of committee. But we did do the informational hearing on those provisions this morning.
So your plan is to bring that bill before the committee, Mr. Chair?
Representative Swasinski, as I've mentioned, we heard those provisions informationally. If they are included in our budget bill, then all members of the committee will have ample opportunity to offer amendments and discuss those provisions. And we had opportunity for questions on those recommendations this morning.
Thank you. Have a question? And just a quick question to Mr. Zimmerman to Mr. Peters.
Go right ahead, Representative Swasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question to the two folks with the electrical unions. Would you support a motion to bring this bill directly to the floor as a standalone bill?
Well, Representative Swasinski, that's a decision of the chair rather than of those individuals.
Well, I understand it's your decision, but I just wanted to get on the record whether or not they would support the concept of actually bringing it to the floor. Obviously, they were consulted with the bill and what's in the bill, and wanted to see if they had opinion on the process of the bill.
Mr. Zimmerman.
I guess I'll leave that up to Mr. Chairman. I don't know. I'm in support of the bill as far as being able to negotiate with the company. And so I'm sorry.
Oh, I thought you were finished. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm in support of the bill as far as it is for the protection of the workers.
Thank you. Mr. Peters.
Hi, I'm in support of the bill as well, just like Kurt, but I would leave the decision to the chair.
Representative Swasinski, do you have further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Micklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to actually thank Representative Christensen for bringing this forward. We've had several amendments in the past 2 years that I've brought forward that do, you know, looking for some type of plan to how we're going to deal with these workers. I have many friends that work at Sherco. I live in Becker Township, so I'm abundantly aware of this, and I actually did sign on to it. I don't think it's posted yet onto this bill. I will kind of back up what Representative Swierinski is saying, that so if you don't understand, if this was a standalone bill and went straight to the floor of the General Registry, it wouldn't get all convoluted in debate and conference committee and all that. And this is such an important thing to our communities that are facing these tougher decisions for many of our employees that have depended on this for many, many years. And some of them being newer won't have the time to finish it out to the Rule 90, as Mr. Zimmerman pointed out. This is very, very important. But I want to thank you, Representative Christensen, for bringing this forward. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Mecklen. And I, too, would like to thank Representative Christensen for bringing this bill forward, and Mr. Zimmerman and Mr. Peters for their hard work on this. This is a really important topic. And I think that this bill is an important mechanism to make sure that we have some public accounting for the plans that utilities have in place to help with their workers in this transition. And I know that Representative Christensen has another bill we'll be hearing soon to also be talking further about helping workers and communities. And so this is a very important conversation as we're undergoing this energy transition. And I'm grateful for Representative Christensen's leadership on this and for the testimony we heard today. And I hope we get this right. It's too important not to. And we know that the workers of IBW and other workers who are involved in this are seeing these changes through no fault of their own. We're seeing our economy shift overall on clean energy, and we need to do right by our workers who've been doing right by us for so many years. So thank you very much, Representative Christensen. Would you have any closing comments you'd like to make?
I'd just like to thank you. Thank you, Mr. Long, and thank you, committee members. And thanks. Yeah, this is a widely bipartisan bill that has passed unanimously through the Senate, et cetera. And, you know, I guess I'd just like to remind us all that the workers at these plants are your neighbors, and they're sitting next to you in church, and they're coaching your little league teams, and they're folks that, as Chair Long said, through no fault of their own, maybe losing their jobs. So I think it's important for all of us to recognize that, and to recognize that that there are ways to help them all when that happens. So thanks much for listening.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Representative Christensen renews her motion, and House File 2054 is laid over. Next, we will be welcoming to the committee Representative Herr for her bill. And it is, I know it's been introduced, but we don't have it in our possession yet. So we posted the language. And Representative Herr, welcome to the committee, and please describe your bill.
Thank you, Chair Long and committee members, for the informational hearing to appropriate funds for microgrid research. This bill is a request for a one-time appropriation of $5.4 million in fiscal year 2022 to the Department of Commerce to transfer to the University of St. Thomas for microgrid research. The grant will be used for three main purposes. First, to increase the center's capacity to provide near commercial scale microgrid testing. Second, to procure additional equipment and controls to expand a microgrid to additional buildings on campus. Third, to expand hands-on microgrid educational opportunities to undergraduate and graduate students, as well as expand partnerships with community colleges. The Center for Microgrid Research at the University of St. Thomas is unique. Flagship microgrid research and educational facility located right here in Minnesota. The center is a distinctive workforce development and renewable energy education asset to Minnesota. It is the only facility in the state that can educate and train our Minnesota grid workforce on microgrids and distributed energy resources. It is estimated that the $5.4 million investment would bring in $10 to $15 million in federal research grants over the next 5 to 10 years and bring national visibility to the region as an innovative partner for microgrid research and education. Investment in this type of energy is important and necessary. Though my bill has not yet been introduced, it will be shortly. My Senate author will be Senator Senjum. I ask for your support as well. With that, Mr. Chair, I conclude my remarks. I do have two testifiers here today to speak on behalf of this bill. The first is Dr. Don Weinkoff, Dean of the University of St. Thomas School of Engineering. If it is all right with you, I yield the rest of my time to Dr. Weinkoff.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Dr. Weinkoff, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Yes, and thank you, committee members. My name is Don Weinkoff. I'm the Dean of the School of Engineering. And if you will, just to cut right to the chase, I know we want to limit our time here. I'm going to share my screen, which is should cover most of the details of what we plan to do with these funds and a little bit of the history of where we got to this point. Can everyone see this screen? Maybe a thumbs up. Good. That's what we always ask in Zoom. Well, first of all, just again, let me thank you for your time. We'd like to talk to you about this request. And particularly, I will also defer to my colleague here, the director of the Microgrid Research Center, Dr. Mahmoud Kabbalan. But really, what I would just give you a brief background, and that is that we see the RDA, and again, the statute states this, is to stimulate research and development of renewable electrical energy technologies. And that's exactly what we've done with our work to date. We have received funding in the 2012-2013 funding cycle, and we've used those resources, I think, really to the benefit of the ratepayers. The second component of this, the RDA stipulations, are to encourage grid modernization. That includes control technology, energy storage, and microgrids, which are specifically designated within the statute. And again, I would like to thank the Xcel Energy ratepayers because we've been able to steward these funds and translate them and transform them into some absolute great assets for the state of Minnesota that we are using right now at the University of St. Thomas. And you'll learn a little bit more about this in this short presentation. And I would add, although the RDA doesn't stipulate workforce development, the facility that we built with these funds really has enabled us to have a strong program for both BS, MS, as well as professional certifications in the whole area of electrical grid, power systems, workforce development. And so that'll be a part of this presentation as well. Just to give you a quick history, we did receive RDF funding in the 2013 cycle. And of course, that was held up a little bit by some issues. And we received $2 million to build this facility. I would say that St. Thomas has added almost an additional $1 million of resources to make this facility happen. So this was the original proposal. And let me just tell you that we have now successfully completed the build out of this microgrid research center at St. Thomas. It's in what the building that's called currently the Facilities and Design Center, right on the St. Paul campus here, right in the heart of the Twin Cities. Here is what it looks like today. It's a versatile, real scale grid connected or islandable microgrid for research and development, company partnering and education. So it entails all of the facets of what a real microgrid research center should have, that versatility. It has controls, it has storage. It has, even if I could call your attention to the dotted line on the corner here, it literally has stations where companies can come and plug in their distributed energy resources. These are very large plugs, by the way. Plug in their distributed energy resources and test them well as they interact with other components on the microgrid. The facility is located, again, on the south campus of the University of St. Thomas. It has a gen set with third-party test bays in our parking garage. It's grid-connected to the Xcel Energy link here at this substation in the Anderson parking facility. And then again, as I said, you're seeing the back of the building here with the Facilities and Design Center with an array of photovoltaics on the roof of the McCarthy Gymnasium. Again, a complete real-scale microgrid system that we use for both research and education at the University of St. Thomas. Just to give you some sense, Ben Volke, the CEO of Xcel Energy, actually flipped the switch to connect this microgrid system to the Xcel microgrid, or through the Xcel grid. And as we were walking out of the building that day, Ben met several of the students who were working on the development of this system. And as we walked out, I remember him commenting to me, I would hire every one of those students that I met today. Really a fantastic national asset for the university. And speaking of that national asset, this facility that we've built at St. Thomas is already attracting national partners. So that visibility for the state of Minnesota to be, you know, a microgrid research leader is happening right before our eyes because of this investment already. We've attracted such partners as General Electric Global Research, Pacific Northwest National Labs, companies, University of Colorado, Boulder. We have attracted other interests in terms of using this resource, both on the company side, but the other national labs like Sandia National Laboratories, MIT. So there's a great deal of interest in what we've built. This is truly an investment for the state of Minnesota. And again, we deeply appreciate the source of this funding as the ratepayers and the customers of Xcel Energy. So with that, I would also just add that you know, we've done some assessment of what really the significance of this grid. And really we're talking about microgrid. We're really talking about a facility which is on the scale of some of the most impressive facilities in the nation, including Arizona State University, Oak Ridge National Labs. And because of that investment, we have now been invited to join a national consortium of microgrid research centers with the top universities in the country. And this might not be something you expect for St. Thomas, but this is the direction that we're going. We're making these investments and we are seeking additional support to make all of this happen. And I would also add that there's a great deal of benefits to the state of Minnesota. And perhaps Mahmoud, Dr. Kabbalon, maybe you could just fill in some of the blanks here with these additional points that we want to make to the committee.
Dr. Kabbalon, welcome, and please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Dr. Mahmoud Kabbalon. I'm a professor at the University of St. Thomas. I'm also the director of the Microgrid Research Center. What we've created, we're very proud of it because it will have substantial benefits to the state of Minnesota. We are a very unique facility, not only in the state of Minnesota in terms of real scale, industry-grade microgrid research, but also we're very unique even for a large portion of the Midwest. We've created a great platform that will allow us to engage with our industry partners to actually test and validate new equipments and controls, which is going to foster innovation in the state of Minnesota in terms of microgrid research and distributed energy resources. And really something that's really great is we are going to be able to educate the engineers and the workforce for the 21st century. So using such a real scale industry grade resource that's on campus, we will be able to educate and train not only bachelor's and master's students, but also provide a venue for professionals to come in and get their professional certifications on standards that are coming up, such as IEEE 1547, which is a very important standard when it comes for distributed energy resources and their connection to the larger grid. And, the best thing about my job, I would say, is, seeing and training young engineers, young bright people, such as Carol Michael. She was one of my students that worked with me back in 2020. She went through it and, it's great teaching theory, but also when you get the privilege to teach people hands-on research, a lot of people just shine and they are able to connect the theory and the practical aspects of their work, which is what we need in terms of our workforce moving into the 21st century.
So thank you, Mahmoud. And again, just to close, we really want to be respectful of everyone's time and get to questions. So the request that we have before you is really to expand the center's operational infrastructure and equipment. And again, all of this is about maintaining our almost near commercial real scale, which is going to basically enable us to be connected to, I would say, the national, system of real scale microgrid research that's happening, that's really going to be advancing. And I will say for the committee members, when we talk about microgrids, it's a critical component to grid reliability that has been so front and center in our work, in our news the last couple of several weeks. And we'll use this resource to procure advanced equipment, really, and to maintain that national prominence that keep Minnesota on the map, so to speak, in terms of microgrid research. And of course, I would say, even though it's not necessarily stipulated, but when you build a facility like this and you integrate students' experience into this facility, you're talking about a workforce development that really is again unparalleled. We want to have continued partnership with community colleges, not only our undergraduate and master students, which, by the way, there are almost 40 master students in our power systems engineering track that are working towards becoming, let's just say, you know, connected and really great participants in our workforce for managing the future grid that we're all moving towards. You know, it is an energy transition, as Chair Long had said, and that transition comes with education. And we feel that not only do we meet the components of the RDA in terms of stimulating research and encouraging grid modernization, but we're doing that with students involved. And so with that, I would just like to thank you. Thank you for your time. And we'd be happy to answer questions about this great project and exciting project for Minnesota.
Thank you so much for the presentation. Looks like we do have member questions. We will begin with Representative Akin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Representative Herr for bringing forward this this bill and this project. I think that this is really exciting. I learned quite a bit about the program at St. Thomas, and I'm excited to hear about it. You talked about within Mr. Let's see, I believe it's Weinkopf. You talked about that kind of the mission of what you're, the work you're doing at St. Thomas is to do research and to educate. And I think that's great. And I appreciate that. And I'm wondering if, in addition to that, there are either opportunities or plans to possibly partner to also implement microgrids in within our state. And if there are any things talked about going in that direction, or if you have any plans, or if you see that as a possibility, I guess maybe is the question.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, and certainly in terms of implementation, that's the idea, is creating the expertise. Dr. Kablan has been working with regional partners as they've expressed interest in trying to expand or implement microgrid components in their own facilities. And so that's what's going to be a part of this. And again, I would say that implementation only comes after workforce development and the numbers of people that are going to be able to support that kind of effort. So we're building expertise, we're building partnerships in a community, and then again, making those resources available for implementation. And if that answers your question, great. And if maybe Dr. Kablan could talk a little bit about that in terms of what his work is in that implementation phase.
Dr. Kablan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So using the experience that we've gained here in-house, just going through the entire commissioning process, which is, of course, has its own challenges, ups and downs. So using my experience that I've gathered in that, I've been reaching out to partners, and partners have been reaching out both in the state of Minnesota and some regional as well. And the whole point is, you know, sharing what we're learning in-house with those partners to just make the transition faster, use this resource as just a vessel for this type of partnerships and spreading the expertise around as fast as possible. So it's definitely something that we're engaged with actively. I'm even meeting with people this Thursday regarding some work. So it's definitely ongoing.
Representative Akin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to both the testifiers for that. I just think that microgrids have such potential around reliability and sustainable power. So I'm excited about it. Good luck with this. And I certainly am supportive of Representative Herr's bill. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to also express my gratitude to Dr. Weinkopf and Dr. Kablan for a very, very exciting and innovative project. It reminds me of a book I read in the 1970s, showing my age here, E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful, which I think opened the door to, you know, really talking about this kind of project, at least from a philosophical standpoint. But my question really is, does the research and does the project envision applications for electric vehicle charging and infrastructure. This has been an important part of our committee's conversation this session, and also in the committee I chair in transportation, we're taking this up as well. So I'm wondering if there are applications or thought given to how this might work with electric vehicle charging.
Dr. Weinkopf.
Well, thank you. Yes, and that's part of the components of this expansion is to really, you know, notice that we're right next to the parking facility. The expansion of use of these funds will expand to include electrical vehicle charging. And again, how does that charging interact with the microgrid? So, or how does it interact with the facilities and the controls? So someone plugs in, someone unplugs. What does that do? There's an instability that always accompanies that. And the controls research and the load sharing, all of those components are what's going to, again, as Dr. Kavalan was saying, accelerate, you know, the application of these microgrids, accelerate the application of really connecting electric vehicles. And by the way, we also, in our master's program in electrical engineering and power systems track, we have a whole course just covering what the impact of electrical vehicles will be on the grid, including microgrids. So the power systems engineers that are getting their hands on practical experience with microgrids are also taking, you know, deep theoretical courses in how these cars, how these vehicles are going to be disrupting and being controlled as they plug in and unplug from the grid.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to thank you, Dr. Weinkopf, for that. And, you know, I'm really very excited that there's an actual course that you teach that gets into that level of specificity on the impacts of this technology. So your work is very much appreciated.
Thank you. It's critically important.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Long, and thank you for being here, testifiers. This is really interesting, and I'm really excited about this. I'm a St. Thomas Law School alum, so I am especially excited about it in that context. And with that in mind, I really want to know if there's going to be collaboration along the lines of undergrad and graduate study programs and what that might look like. And then also what implications there are for expanding these projects as we gain more information and more knowledge. So if anybody can speak to that, I would really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And certainly the integration into the undergraduate and graduate programs already exists. We have designed what's called an electrical engineering power systems track within our undergraduate program and our graduate program. So when a student signs up for a master's program in electrical engineering or an undergraduate program in electrical engineering, they're already tracked into what we call power systems engineering. And so that is an integral part of this component. Like I said, the RDA doesn't demand educational components, but it's really the kicker that comes with having a facility, research facility like this, that is available for that kind of education. And yes, so expansion of that work, and as Dr. Kavalan said, it also includes things like expansion to professional certifications and IEEE. So we may have engineers that are out working for Xcel Energy, but now as the proliferation, acceleration of these types of systems on the grid are happening, they need to be certified and upgraded. So this facility would literally provide, an opportunity for students and professionals to get hands-on education in the certifications, which are evolving, you know, as we speak. I believe the IEEE 1547 came out in 2018, and now we need to be making. And Minnesota is adopting that standard. And now what we need to do is make sure that all of the grid and microgrid workers and distributed energy resources are trained in that particular area.
Representative Herr.
And Chair Long, I just wanted to add to kind of along the same lines as Representative Hollins' question, is that the funding will allow the center to expand training to Minnesota Grid Workforce as a true learning lab on new concepts throughout workshops and certifications. But I think what's exciting to me is the funding will also allow St. Thomas to develop a two-year community college partnership program to provide students hands-on power systems research experience and training through paid summer internships. I think that we all know that there is a need to develop and to train, and that, you know, a four-year college isn't always for everybody, and that we need to have training programs that allow people to get into this field and into the sector and doing work. And oftentimes this disproportionately impacts our communities of color and individuals who might not have the privilege of going to a four-year college to afford that, but they can a two-year community college that'll get them into the workforce and into well-paying jobs. And so I think that that's really important to point out.
Representative Hollins, did you have a follow-up?
Sorry, multitasking. I appreciate everything that you're saying. I guess the one thing I would, I wanted to poke at a little bit, being an alum from the law school, is how we might be able to integrate environmental lawyers into this and have them be a part of the solution in this programming. And then I'm also interested to know how, and I think we're going to talk about this, I think I have a meeting scheduled later this week, but how this will relate to energy storage, which we know is like the next big thing that we really need to be working on with regards to climate, climate change and switching to renewable energy. So if anybody could speak to that, that would be great.
Dr. Weinkopf?
Yeah, I certainly could speak to the latter part, and that all microgrids are going to be have an energy storage component. And those interactions with the microgrid are really what's at the source of the study. I mean, a cloud floats over a PV, a PV solar array, or a diesel generator shuts off, or the wind dies. All of those interactions are really what's at the heart of this research, and that is to provide better control algorithms, more responsive control algorithms, so that these microgrids, in order for them to be adopted, they're going to have to be equally as reliable as when you plug in, your toaster. So that is the key part here, is that storage does play a key role. In terms of getting back to your original point about the, environmental law and things like that. And again, St. Thomas is a very integrated, we have students from business taking data science courses in our software engineering courses, artificial intelligence. We're a very, a university that's connected at almost every level, and certainly in terms of experience with what these microgrids are, will be a component of our work. We are a very, collaborative institution with very few barriers. As I said, you can be in our MBA program and taking a class in artificial intelligence or machine learning, as an example. And I would expect the same for our law school.
Representative Hur, did you have any closing comments to your bill?
Just a real quick closing comment. I just want to say thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to come before you and share this cutting edge work of microgrid at the University of St. Thomas. I think that there's been some great feedback in this committee and just great support for it. And I, take back what Representative Hollins is asking, because we do need to always find better ways to cross-sectionally train our individuals who are coming out of our higher ed institutions. So it's great. It's something for us to continue to keep in mind. And that I just ask for your support and appreciate your time today. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Hur, so much for this bill. So members, tomorrow we have added a hearing that we let members know about last week, but just wanted to remind everyone that at 6 p.m. We will be convening to hear a bill that I am carrying on trying to address the spikes in gas prices and the impacts that those are having on ratepayers and on our municipal utilities in particular. And we will also be hearing a bill from Representative Bierman tomorrow night. So amendment deadline is 6 p.m. tonight for those two bills. And I hope members can attend tomorrow. It should be an important hearing and a timely one. Looks like we're going to wrap up a few minutes early. So thanks for your time, everyone, today. And with that, we are adjourned.